Welcome to the MacGuffin Man. I'm Alex, and with me this week is Snarf. Be sure to check out our website, themacguffinmen.com. We've most recently talked about Mad Max Fury Road. Before that, we've talked about Ex Machina, It Follows. We did a video podcast on The Graduate. And before that, we did another audio podcast on Clueless. So you can find those all at our website, themacguffinmen.com. You can also find them on iTunes if you would like to subscribe to us there. Also, you can follow us on Twitter to get all of the pertinent updates about what we are up to. But yeah, let's just get to the episode.
Welcome to the MacGuffin Man. And now, here are Alex and James.
All right, James.
Yes.
We're here to discuss
Swingers.
No, I thought it was Couples Retreat. I thought it was the other Vince Vaughn, Jon Favreau classic.
No, fortunately, it is Swingers.
Okay, all right. Well, luckily, I watched it a bunch about 10 years ago, so I'm still prepared, but I wish I hadn't watched Couples Retreat twice.
Yeah, this is the breakout for Favreau and Vince Vaughn and Big Way.
And Doug Liman as well.
Yeah, and Doug Liman. I saw this movie a lot when I was younger and then fell in love with the Bourne movies and didn't really realize Doug Liman was involved with this movie.
Gotcha. See, I saw The Bourne Identity knowing it was the director of Swingers. So I expected a totally different kind of film.
Yeah, I would imagine so.
Yeah, it's about Trent's alcoholism. He wakes up one day and can't remember what he's been doing for 10 years.
So you did see this a lot 10 years ago, you said?
Yeah, I certainly saw it a bunch of times, yeah. It's one of those movies that was just sort of on the pile of VHS copies that got passed around the halls of high schools. You know? And that happened probably up until my graduating class, basically, you know?
Peer-to-peer sharing.
Yeah, exactly.
So how did you feel about it then, and how did you feel about it now?
I thought it was quite fun back then. I enjoyed it. I thought it was very funny. I still feel that way. I have to say, really surprised at how much I like this movie watching it again. There are certainly things I don't like about it, and things about it that are problematic that mostly tie into the time period, but,
The 2 weeks when Swing Revival is cool.
Yeah, exactly. I know we talked about Clueless a couple weeks ago too. It's just like we've been doing a couple of 1996 movies, so we've been talking about the year of Swing apparently. But yeah, no, it's I really was surprised at how much I liked parts of this movie, having not seen it in at least a decade. Yeah, I thought it was great. And contrary to what his opinions on gun control might make you believe, I still really like Vince Vaughn, so I'm still still on board there. Yeah,
I mean, this is prime Vince Vaughn.
Oh my god, this is like one of those performances where you're just, you know, some executive is watching this movie and being like, that kid's a star, you know?
Yeah, well, that's how he got into Lost World.
Yes, I did know that, actually. That executive in this case is Steven Spielberg. And also yeah. Gus Van Sant, and also whoever greenlit The Cell, probably.
Yeah. Okay, so let's talk about the movie a bit.
No, I want to know how you feel about this movie.
Oh, okay. No, I like it. I remember liking it, you know, probably around the same time you were watching it in high school. Mm-hmm. And feeling like I was missing something, like I just didn't like it as much as kind of my brother, who was 5 years older than me, who would have been at a good age when this movie came out to appreciate it. Mm-hmm. I feel like I was missing something, even though I did like parts of it. I think I know what I was missing now. I still don't love the movie, but I still do enjoy it, and it's just a very interesting movie to watch, and it's a very interesting movie to learn how it came about. Mm. And it's in a very interesting time for independent filmmaking as well. So
oh, yeah, for sure.
All things considered, for you know who was involved and how much time and money was spent on it, I'd say it's a great success.
Yeah.
I'm not dying to rewatch it again anytime soon, but its cult following makes a bit more sense to me now. Okay. So I'm happy about that.
Okay. Because what of your long-held demons has been exercised? Now you get Swingers. You've finally done it. All yeah. those nights of losing sleep, wondering why you didn't get it.
What is it, Fabs? What is it in your mind? No, I am not a 20s to 30s actor in Los Angeles. I'm nowhere close to that. Mm-hmm. But I have more of an understanding of how that whole thing works now and how that makes sense. This is, it's a breakup movie, but it's a relationship movie. It's about kind of your first real relationship, not, the girl in grade 10 who didn't like you back or whatever. This is much more like, you know, the mid 20s kind of, you've had a real relationship and it's come and gone. And then something else, yeah, you're looking for something else or trying to get through it or whatever. That makes more sense to me than it did when I was 13.
Yeah. when you hadn't been in 6-year relationships when you were 13?
No, I hadn't, believe it or not, because I didn't start dating someone when I was 7. Well,
some of us just get an earlier start than others.
I guess so. No, I mean, the Hollywood aspect makes more sense to me now. The kind of relationship aspect makes more sense. And this is a very... kind of adult male friendship movie as well. Mm-hmm. And so I think we'll leave that one alone. I think just life experiences makes this more interesting, and having a better understanding of filmmaking, I think, mm-hmm. Adds to my enjoyment of this movie.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah. Do you want to talk about the production first, or you want to get to the movie first?
Well, I think it's something that we can talk about pretty quickly. It's that, they tried to get this screenplay made. Like, Favreau kind of wrote this movie basically about his experiences trying to be an actor, and he was friends with Vince Vaughn and Ron Livingston and wrote their parts for them. And I don't know how Doug Liman got involved, if he was friends with Favreau as well, but they shopped this movie around two studios, and everybody passed when Doug Liman said who he wanted to cast. I think there was interest in the movie, but not interest with this cast. So it was kind of like, it was like a Rocky situation where it was just sort of like, it's this movie or not, and we have to figure out a way to make this movie the way we want to make this movie. And what they ended up doing was making it very cheaply. And then, scrounging up the funds from independent producers and whatnot, and then eventually they made the movie for, I believe, about $200,000, and it played really well and got purchased by the Weinsteins, Miramax at the time.
Yeah, so as you said, Jon Favreau wrote this and, as you said, shopped it around, and it was getting traction, but I think every studio said, yeah, we'll give you $8 million if we can put actually famous people in this movie, so people will actually go see it. And I guess Jon Favreau just felt pretty adamant that he wanted it to be the movie that he wrote and didn't want to change too many things just for the sake of budget, and not just, you know, putting a star in, but there was a lot of talk of turning Trent's character to, not going to Vegas, just changing a lot of very fundamental things about the script. And
sorry, changing Trent's character, you cut out for a second.
To a female.
Oh, okay.
That was one note that they got that, and Jon Favreau and the other people involved just weren't really willing to budge on it. And Doug Liman, who sounds like a very interesting person.
Oh, he's kind of a nut.
Yeah, he sounds like insane.
Yeah.
But I guess he wanted to make it in the entertainment world. He comes from a very wealthy family. His father, Arthur Liman, is. Played a pivotal role in the Iran-Contra hearings, and he comes from a very wealthy kind of influential family. Uh-huh. He was able to get $200,000 from one of his friends or business partners to make this movie, and so it kind of kind of gave a lot more power to Doug Liman and his director, because he also was the source of so much of the funding of this movie. So that's interesting. And yes, Doug Liman's insane.
Well, there was this really good, I think it was the LA Times did a really good piece on him when Edge of Tomorrow was coming out, the Tom Cruise, Emily Blunt movie that he directed most recently, about the production of that movie and how in his first meeting with Tom Cruise and Emily Blunt, he was just like, I don't know how we're going to do this, but we're going to make it up as we go along or something like that. And it's a really, really interesting piece. And I highly recommend you check it out. I wish I had more details, but it was really funny at the time. And it's kind of really scanned. It really scanned with what I previously knew about him, that he's a true artist, I suppose you could say.
Yeah. And I think that kind of, you know, fly by the seat of your pants, guerrilla style filmmaking suited this movie really well because of who was involved and how much, aka how little money was involved.
Yeah, exactly.
But I think by the time you're dealing with a Tom Cruise 2014 movie, yeah. You know, I thought his tune would change a little bit, but from what it sounds like, that is not the case.
No, but yeah, and there's moments all throughout his career where that's really kind of helped. Like there's a shot in The Bourne Identity, which is the only one of the Bourne movies that he has directed. There, I did it. And there's a shot where he's just on a boat. I think it's after he's been picked up by the fishermen or whatever near the beginning. And it's dusk, and it's a really nice, gorgeous shot of him just standing on the boat. And that was entirely Doug Liman just being like, oh, we have just enough light to get the shot. Let's get it. They had already wrapped for the day. And it's a really nice moment in the film, a nice shot. And I remember one of the producers, I think, in a behind-the-scenes piece talking about him being like, yeah, that's a shot we never would have thought to get, but it's just sort of like Doug Liman comes from the just because you're wrapped doesn't mean you're wrapped sort of world. And yeah, it's helpful. And, you know, when it's not annoying the people around you, you know, it's great.
And I guess there was a bit of you know, tension between Jon Favreau and Doug Liman during the making of this movie as well.
Surprise me.
Yeah, and people working 16-hour days for very little money. Mm-hmm. You know, I think people just get on each other's nerves.
Well, and especially since you've got Jon Favreau, who would eventually become a director. Like, to be a director, you have to be a very specific kind of stubborn, and to have two of those people going head to head, one of them being a writer, one of them being the director, I can imagine that leading to problems more often than not.
Yeah, and you know, Favreau definitely, you know, as we said, why his willingness to turn down money in exchange for some changes to his script. You know, he really did, you know, stick to his guns, and he had a certain vision for this movie and wanted to stick to it. And so it was doing it with Doug Liman and doing it with very little money that, you know, kind of allowed them to make maybe not exactly what they wanted because of some technical limitations, but at least stick truer to the script. That's for sure.
Yeah, absolutely.
And as you mentioned, Jon Favreau and Vince Vaughn really were, maybe perhaps now are, still best friends.
Yeah.
I didn't know they met on the set of Rudy. That was a fun find.
Oh, you didn't know that?
No, I didn't.
That was always a big part of the Favreau Vaughn mythos.
Man, I love it. Yeah. And I don't mean it by the movie Rudy. And just, I think one interesting thing, I mean, he said, I don't know how true this is, he kind of, his father had, Jon Favreau's father had bought him a, like a script writing program, just a kind of a template that you could, you know, punch things into and start making a script. And he said this script was written in 2 weeks and kind of just a way to experiment with that. But for a movie that with this little budget, and for someone who's, I think, naturally as charismatic as Vince Vaughn is, there's very little improvisation in this movie, is my understanding. And I think it's just being friends with Vince Vaughn for so long that he was able to write for him so effectively and really find Vince Vaughn's voice. And I don't think there's a huge difference between Trent and Vince Vaughn. I bet Vince Vaughn...
There is not. Yeah. Listen to his WTF with Marc Maron for further proof of that. He's just nonstop, I am here to entertain.
Yeah. And I mean, that's what we love about Vince Vaughn.
Absolutely what I love about him.
Yeah. And I mean, I can't remember another SNL monologue where they just said, go,
oh my
be,
God.
Go be yourself for 6 minutes on live TV and then we'll cut to commercial.
And he and the fact that he crushed it in that, too. Like, that's,
oh, absolutely.
That monologue's so fucking impressive. Anyways, continue.
Yeah, no, I just mean, it's, you could, the fact that there is so little improvisation, I think, speaks to the fact that he really did know Vince Vaughn well, and he was able to write for him on the paper in such a way that is absolutely believable to how he acts. Like, I think Vince Vaughn is such a scene stealer in this movie. He's obviously the more entertaining character because Mike, Jon Favreau's character, is just the quiet, less confident, you know, complaining about his ex-girlfriend and doing cringeworthy things like bringing her up on dates and leaving all those voicemails and things like that. He's not supposed to be the fun one in the movie. That's clearly left up to Trent's character. But I just think it's impressive that he was able to write for someone who seems so off the cuff, funny, and so bubbly the way that Vince Vaughn is, especially in this movie. I just think that's very impressive.
Yeah, for sure. And it's impressive that Vince Vaughn, if he's going off the page at all times, it's impressive that it's that natural, you know? Even if they are written in his voice, it's still like him reading words in his voice, remembering them, and then still getting them across like he's speaking them for the first time. So, because it is a very natural performance.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And, that also, I mean, so many things about this movie are natural because they didn't have the money to do it the other way. Mm-hmm. And it's also a very, kind of autobiographical story. They were friends in LA who were struggling to make it as actors. And it's funny that, I mean, this is, they had worked before, but for Vince Vaughn, Ron Livingston, and Jon Favreau, they were all people in LA who made this movie as friends about actors trying to make it. And for so many of them, it was the movie that had them make it. You know what I mean?
Yeah, for sure.
It's pretty incredible.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's fun reading. I don't know if, did you read the oral history of this movie on Grantland?
No, I did not. I might have when it first came out, but I didn't read it recently.
Yeah, it's pretty interesting just reading all the shortcuts they took, and you know, there's parts where you can hear police on the soundtrack because they were filming right next to cops or asking them where their permits were and stuff like that.
Yeah.
And I mean, we're still shooting on film at this time, you know what I mean? This is 90, released in 96, so, you know, shooting before that or early in the year. So we certainly don't have all the digital filmmaking technology that we have now. Mm-hmm. And film came in 1,000-foot or 400-foot rolls. Mm-hmm. And film was very expensive. And so what they would do is, you know, buy the tail end of these rolls from movies like Twister and other big movies that were in production at the time. And they would just buy the last like 100 feet, and you know, you maybe if you can only shoot a minute on what you're able to buy for cheap, that's fine. But that's, you know, this is just the budgetary restraints that they were working in. So if you want to learn a bunch of cool stuff about cheap filmmaking in the mid-90s, feel free to read that oral history.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah.
I actually did remember. I recall that now that you're talking about the end of film reels. that's the type of specificity that will stick with you.
Yeah. Yeah, and I mean, as I said, I think my appreciation of this movie, I think, was increased by, you know, learning all the restrictions they were under and the budgetary things like that. I forgot, like, it just watching it through that lens this time. I forgot that the movie starts off with, you know, still images, like a pretty unglamorous set of images of people partying, like just poorly lit and without red eye reduction. Mm-hmm. What do you think of that intro?
I've always found it a bit boring. The thing I do really like about it is I enjoy the audio opening leading into the song. Like it's the performance is about to begin sort of thing. It's kind of like, I think, you know, to play with a line that comes about 10 minutes later in the film, it's kind of quietly telling us that this film is about the guy before the guy. Like, I think there's a real coming of age moment for Mike in this movie. And I think that's sort of like You know, he's clearing his throat throughout the entirety of this movie to become like the adult that he will end up being, you know, like how, you know, you're an adult when you're 18, but you're not like a real person until you're probably like 30, you know? And I think this movie's very much, about that transition, you know? And for that reason, I really like the intro, but as far as the pictures, I wasn't crazy about it. Yourself?
Yeah, I mean, I don't really know how I feel about it. I like the point that you bring up about a coming of age story, and how that opening bit of audio kind of sets the scene for that. Yeah, to me, I don't know. I do like the still images. I like that it's people who aren't in the movie. Something about that I really appreciate, that it's just strangers, like, as far as we're concerned. We don't know who these people are, and we never find out. And, you know, I think it speaks to how unglamorous Hollywood and Los Angeles and being a struggling actor can be at times. You know, that's something that we see a ton in this movie. And it just reminds me of the way that all the parties are shot. You know, they just went into the bars that they actually would go to and drink at and just started shooting their movie there. Mm-hmm. And so it's just, it's lit differently than other movies. And by lit differently, I meant
not lit.
Lit less. Yeah. But it does give it an authentic feel. I mean, you can't, looks a lot more like you're out at the bar with them. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I think that's part of the charm, is that it's so naturalistic.
Yeah, no, I would agree with that for sure.
But you're someone who lighting would bother more than me. So how is it for you watching?
Oh, no, I think it's fine, because especially at this point, you know, the legend of Swingers precedes it. Like, I know it's a very low budget movie, and I know all of these things, and I know you're going to be dealing with a lot of utilitarianism in the production. Yeah, it doesn't bother me at all. Like, you know, I kind of looked for as much stuff filmmaking wise that I could find throughout the movie. You know, looking at it now, 10 years later, now that I know all the stuff I know about like making video and whatnot, and there's not a lot to it. It really is a lot of, feels like a movie where it's like, we've got to get what we can when we can. And, you know, there's no real show off dolly shots for Doug Liman, you know, just because there was no ability to, and a lot of faces are underexposed and stuff, just because I guess that the way the light fell on them. But yeah, it does add a naturalistic tone that I think helps. The one thing that I did kind of think about a lot with this movie is just how specific a kind of person you have to be able to pull off, to be a director and to pull off this type of thing, like to be able to talk these bars into letting them use their bar as a set while their bar is in operation, and all of those little things. And it's just like all of these things that every time I learn something like that, I'm just like, I will never be a filmmaker. I just don't have the capacity to do this, you know? And that's the thing. That's the Doug Liman auteur voice present in this film, is the, holy shit, how did he pull that off, basically, you know?
Yeah.
And not something that necessarily translates on the screen in like a tilt or a pan, but it's something that is on screen, and you just think about all the stuff that went into getting it on screen.
Yeah, there's in that oral history as well, they're talking about, they had, I think it was a producer, was this woman who, she said, like, she was just like, I'm not above crying in front of people to get my way. Like, just when they'd go to a location they want, they would just argue and cry until they let them use it for free or for cheap or something.
That's funny.
And another lighting thing, while you're talking about that I thought of was that scene where Mike's on the phone. I think it's when Trent's trying to convince him to go to Vegas. Mm-hmm. And he's just walking around his room, and he opens his fridge a few times. Jon Favreau said that, you know, he was told there just wasn't enough light in that scene, so he opens the fridge a few times. But I think it actually works really thematically. I thought, like, maybe that just was the necessity and there's no other thought to it. But as he's doing that, like, he opens his fridge, walks to the other room, walks back, opens his fridge. And he's just talking about how cyclical their life is, and how they just go out and see these same nasty skanks and go to the same bars, and like that their whole life is just such a loop and it never goes anywhere, and they're just treading water. And he's, you know, literally just pacing back and forth, opening the fridge, getting nothing out, walking away from the fridge, coming back to it, opening the fridge, getting nothing out. you know, it's just one of those times that I think it seems that there was some, you know, filmmaking necessity to just have more light to it. But it works out really well for the story that they're being told, and just where Mike is as a character at that point, just really fed up with this the cyclical nature of what they do. And I thought that was a really nice touch.
Yeah, and also people on the phone tend to just sort of have a tendency to pace in general. So it adds another element of realism as well, even yeah. outside of the thematic stuff that you're talking about there.
Yeah. So is this movie like Entourage for people who haven't made it yet?
One of my notes is Entourage for realists.
Okay. Yeah, yeah. That makes more sense.
I think like that's the best possible way to describe this movie is just that it's Entourage for people that understand that life is not like Entourage, you know. I think it's really telling that Mark Wahlberg gets Entourage made after Mark Wahlberg is a superstar, and Jon Favreau and Doug Liman and Vince Vaughn and Ron Livingston get Swingers made before they're stars, you know. Like that, like there's just there's no better way to explain it than that, you know.
Yeah.
And you have all of the things that are a part of Entourage. You know, it's very much a male hangout movie. It's very much about getting girls, and it's a comedy.
LA with, actors.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. But everything is done a bit differently. Like everything in Entourage for the most part is pretty pretty what, like if we're seeing a golf scene in Entourage, I bet fucking Adrian Grenier gets a hole in one every hole or something. And then Jeremy Piven's like, I can't believe it. Just is manic for a minute and then insults Lloyd. But in this movie, you know, they're terrible at golf. Like, I love the scene where they're playing golf and they're just so terrible at it. And that type of stuff makes me so happy that I see in hangout movies. And, you know, another example, like in Entourage, if they're going to Vegas, it's them driving to a private plane and then they land in Vegas, you know. If in this movie, I think the way they get the road trip idea across is really great. It's like, we're going to Vegas, and they're all excited at the beginning of the trip, and then they just kind of get tuckered out on the way, you know.
Yeah, like it's Mike's like falling asleep. Yeah,
yeah. And it's kind of like the fridge thing that you were talking about. It has this sort of thematic resonance, because, you know, when these guys come out to LA, they start out with such high hopes, and then they kind of just get tired on the along the way there to where they think they want to be, and just end up wanting to go to sleep and going home to Queens, you know. Yeah. And I love that stuff in this movie, is the same things you see in Entourage but with a much more normal look at it, you know.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And I haven't watched enough Entourage, I guess is how all that works out as well.
Yeah, I can be the podcast resident Entourage expert. I've seen enough to know.
Congratulations.
Yeah, I really worked hard for that one.
Yeah,
my award's in the mail.
I also thought another very accurate part of this movie was when they're drunk. I thought this was one of my like most accurate drunk acting I've ever seen in a movie.
Yes, there is a lot of good drunk acting in this movie. One part that I took umbrage with, and maybe this is just an LA thing, was that there's five guys going out in five cars.
that was with five clubs.
Well, yeah. And that seemed a little inefficient. Yeah.
Yeah. Especially because, you know, I imagine at least four of them are drinking.
Yeah. Well, yeah, exactly. And the whatever. Yeah, it's the night where they go to a bar and then meet the guys for a bite, and then go to a party, and then go to another party, and then go back to the Dresden to end the night with guns. that night ends in them all being drunk and driving home, for sure.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Yeah, it appears the other ones were more responsible because they had a DD in one vehicle.
Yeah, exactly. So
more environmentally friendly. Yeah. Yeah, just about that scene. Vince Vaughn, I guess, had them change that scene a little bit, where he, in the original script, kind of doesn't really stick up for Mike as much as he does in the final version. And mm-hmm. I think that there was the concern from Vince Vaughn that Trent just wouldn't be a likable character, that, you know, all the time he's trying to tell Mike how to live his life and how to do things differently, that maybe they aren't really friends, and he's just kind of exploiting him or whatever, just to not be lonely. Mm-hmm. And it's really one of the few times that he seems to be, you know, clearly defending his friend for no personal interest. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
The way he, you know, starts getting in Sue's face for not just pulling the gun, but for insulting him about, you know, the way he talks about his girlfriend all the time or how he hasn't got laid since then, things mm-hmm. like that. So, I mean, it's not really like a really soft spot of the movie. There isn't tons of those in this movie, really, but it's just one that kind of bolsters his character to be a bit more likable.
Exactly. It's like any friendship. It's that, you know, there's a lot of bullshit in between the few moments where somebody actually has to stand up and say something real. But, you know, basically the basis of friendship is that you trust that when something happens that somebody needs to speak up about, that they will, you know. And and I like that scene a lot because of that, and especially since Trent is such a character throughout the whole movie. Anytime you get sort of a hint of humanity, it's it adds a really nice element, because I think Vince Vaughn, I know this is really high praise, and I don't mean it to be as high as it's going to sound, but Vince Vaughn really has that sort of, at his best, has that Bill Murray sort of vibe where he exists in the world and doesn't care about anything within it except really for himself. And in all of Bill Murray's best comedy roles, you really see that. Like Ghostbusters is about a man inside the apocalypse and not caring at all, you know, and never being shaken by the apocalypse. And I think you get a lot when Vince Vaughn's actually being really good in a comedy, that's what you get. And I think having a little bit of grounding to that character is really helpful, and especially in a movie like Swingers, where I think you kind of need Mike to have somebody other than Ron Livingston. You know, like, you know, there needs to be a reason he hangs out with Trent, because that's the other thing about Trent that I think about a lot in this movie is how I could just never hang out with him, ever.
Yeah.
Like, I find Vince Vaughn so goddamn funny from a distance. I bet he is a terror. Like, I would just not like being around him at all.
Yeah. You know? Oh yeah. The restaurant scene.
That baby's all grows up.
Yeah. And like getting other people involved. Yeah. You would draw the line way before Mike does in that scene.
I'd be pissed off that he gave his
corned beef away?
Gave his corned beef hash to somebody that wasn't me.
Yeah, exactly.
I love that shit. You know.
Yeah, but to go back to that scene where we kind of get some humanity, I think it's good because it doesn't ring false. You know what I mean? He's not so soft. It's not this, you know, they don't put in some violin on the soundtrack and he tells him how much his friendship really means
yeah,
to
exactly.
him. You know, he just stands up for him in a genuine way, and just, you know, he does it by telling the other guy to fuck off. You know, it's not like it's some, you know, oversweet moment or anything, but it's effective. And I think, you know, those two characters, I think, kind of represent guys in their 20s, like the two sides of them. You know, Trent is the, you know, louder and overconfident and brash and kind of deluded. And then Mike is the shyer, less secure kind of guy. And, you know, I don't think that those things are mutually exclusive. Like, I think kind of at that point in your life, and maybe I'm thinking kind of lower 20s, late teens, but I think that exists in a lot of guys. It's kind of the two things like that. And I think the overconfidence is maybe not completely true, but it's just putting up that front. So it's the two sides of the coin with those two. And then, you know, and it's their interaction. I mean, there's so much of the two of them on screen together. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that's what really makes this movie. And, you know, because it doesn't have a lot of heart without Mike, and it doesn't have a lot of comedy without Trent. So
yeah, exactly.
It's the two of them together that I think makes it. And just speaking kind of about male friendship, it's, you know, Mike does basically all the times Mike does the silliest things is when he's alone. Like, you can tell he really does need or value like the friends that he has, because, you know, leaving all those voicemails, like all the really cringeworthy stuff in this movie for the most part is Mike alone. And, you know, he's just at a vulnerable point in his life and needs his friends around. And we see that very much with Trent, but we see it a lot with Rob too. Like, he's very, very helpful towards him at a time when he just when he needs it a lot.
Yeah, for sure. Just going back to that one scene that we talked about with Trent telling off Sue. The other thing that's cool about that scene is Trent telling off a friend. Like, he's clearly I think if the roles were reversed, he would say the same thing to Mike. It's just that, like, he just because you're friends with this person doesn't mean you're not going to call them out when they step over the line. And I like that a lot. I think that's it's a nice thing, both that he sticks up for Mike and that he's willing to yell at Sue, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
How do you compare this? I mean, if we're talking about male friendship movies and breakup movies, how do you compare this to the Apatow kind of male friendship subgenre that's developed in the meantime?
I don't know. I mean, there's a scene in Knocked Up where Paul Rudd and Seth Rogen go to Vegas. There's
true.
That.
True.
I don't remember if they get tired on the road trip along the way, but yeah, I don't know. There are certainly similarities, but there's some, and there's yeah, I don't know. I don't have any thoughts. I'm just going to mumble and spit something out, but I don't have any clear thoughts about it.
Okay. I just thought you'd want any reason to talk about Judd Apatow.
I always do. And I just feel like if I, because Knocked Up is, I think, Judd Apatow's big contribution to culture as a filmmaker. And I think Knocked Up is kind of just a better movie about growing up than Swingers is. You know, they're kind of about the same thing in different ways, and Knocked Up is better, you know?
Yeah.
But it's not to say that Swingers is bad. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. I also just like Seth Rogen more than I like Jon Favreau. Seth Rogen never made Chef.
I didn't see that, so I can't be too upset about it.
It was a real piece of shit. You would have hated it. Okay. You know those movies that end in divorced parents getting back together and how much you love those?
Zero?
Yeah, exactly.
So that movie's a no?
Now imagine the mother of Sofia Vergara, and now imagine how much you love that movie.
Oh, God, that's terrible.
I actually don't remember if they get back together at the end of that movie, but that movie certainly ends with them dancing together, yeah. And it's the worst.
So how do you feel about the ending of
Chef?
This movie?
Chef? I hate Chef. Chef is the ending of this movie, I think, which part? Because I think there's kind of like two important endings to this movie. And they both come back to back. And there's one that I love and one that I hate.
Okay. Well, I'll just break down both of them for you.
Okay. So what I believe are the last two scenes are the scene where he talks to Michelle and then Lorraine on the phone. Michelle being his ex-girlfriend and Lorraine being Heather Graham. And then the actual last scene of the movie is where him and Trent are hanging out in a diner drinking coffee together, basically talking about the scene that just ended. Hate the former, love the latter. I hate that Michelle calls him. I hate it so much. I wish that, and I know they set it up with the maybe the very first scene of the movie where Rob and Mike are talking about how forlorn Mike is and how why doesn't she call, and it's like she won't call until you're really over her, and
Chekhov's ex-girlfriend.
Yeah, exactly. And I just I wish she had just gone away, you know, like, and that because, that she, sorry.
Yeah, because that's what they do, you know.
Yeah, exactly.
I have a big problem with that part.
It's
as well.
It gives Mike a victory, and I don't like that. Like, Mike already had a victory, but it gives him like a victory over Michelle, and I think that is problematic.
Yeah, because at that point, it's just like it turns more into spite than moving on and just getting like in moving on with your life.
Yeah, exactly, and yeah. Don't like that at all.
You're right, it's a victory. It's kind of just like, oh, now I don't have to, I'm not gonna call her back, like this is my win, like I won the breakup now because yeah, exactly. She wants me back, and I just think that's I don't know, like for a movie about your first real relationship, like that seems so petty and childish. Like that's the way maybe a high school relationship,
yeah,
when you're still immature enough to think of things in like terms like that, like victory in a breakup. I think for a real adult movie, that should be, you should have matured past that.
Exactly. It's something Trent should care about and not something Mike should care about. And yeah. I'm not crazy. Like, I would have liked it better if he called Lorraine, like, immediately the next day. But I think the follow-up scene in the diner makes that less problematic because, do you have anything else to add about the phone scene?
Yeah, I think the timing I don't like either. I don't like that she calls at the same time.
It's the worst.
Yeah.
It's worse than Chef.
Where's the chef? I also don't, and kind of by the same token of like, you know, winning or having a kind of a spite ending to something. I don't like that Mike doesn't seem to move on as much as he finds a replacement. Mm-hmm. I have a big problem with that. You know, like we talked about on Boyhood and tons of movies that end with this idea that it's about, like, so much of this movie has been about getting over someone and being happy with yourself and living your own life. I find it really disingenuous to totally undercut that with find someone else. You know what I mean? Like, that's, it seems so antithetical to the be happy without her to just say, oh, find a new her. Mm-hmm. That's always really cheap to me. And I think it is a way, like, kind of in the language of cinema, it is a shortcut to say, like, well, clearly he must be over this person if he's on to this person. But I just find it disingenuous to the idea of independence and a breakup kind of ending when you're over the person, not when you've replaced them. That's problematic for me and happens in way more movies. And this isn't the movie that should happen. How realistic so many other elements of this movie are, mm-hmm. that one just doesn't ring true for me at all.
Yeah, no, I agree. And I think a big part of what I like about this movie now is that it's all about a guy who is forced to kind of re-inject himself back into a world that he thought he had left forever, that world being the life of single people. And he's especially in the opening of the movie, we're seeing Mike try to figure out how to be single again. And it's like that phone conversation that happens where he's circling his apartment and he's basically, I'm paraphrasing, but he's talking about driving, you know, we're going to drive around the hills looking for one party. Then we're going to say it sucks. Then we're going to drive around for another. And then we're going to go to the bars and all the bars suck. And it's just a guy not wanting to be in the world he's in because he was a part of the world that he wanted to be in. And, you know, he doesn't want to be in a trailer with two girls he doesn't know at 6 a.m. You know, like, that's just not something he wants in his life. And the whole struggle of that movie, the movie kind of comes in him being a part of this through no choice of his own. Like, he desperately doesn't want to be a part of it. It's just kind of, he doesn't know anything else to do. And and that's kind of like one of the things that bugged me when I sent you a text about it the other day, when I said something like, drink every time somebody refers to a woman as a beautiful baby or a skank or something like that. And in the first 20 minutes of the movie, I was just like, oh my God, is it going to be like this the whole time? You know? And turns out that not entirely. There's not as much use of skank as you would think, coming from the first 10 minutes when they're in Vegas or whatever. But it's certainly, you know, a lot. And what I think the movie kind of does well is show that Mike is kind of playing a role. He's playing the role of Trent, and the movie doesn't demonize Trent, but at the ending, it doesn't make Trent's way of life seem like the way of life that Mike should be living or that anybody should be living. And I think that's interesting. And that's what I like about the diner scene at the end, where we see Trent hitting on a mom who is actually, like, talking to her baby and just sort of showing how infantile the whole process of being single in your 20s is, and how silly it is, and how you know, the movie ends with Trent looking out a window, or sorry, not Trent, Mike looking out a window and just basically ignoring Trent while Trent is still trying to talk to him. And even in the setup of that scene, we see that Trent's placemat is covered in spilled coffee. Even like, so the beginning of that scene must be him spilling coffee, and then he gets a refill and just still has the spilled on placemat. His hands have writing all over them, and he's doing baby talk, you know, like it's just, he's set up to be so infantile, and all of his games and the way he lives his life are set up to be so infantile. And it's all about Mike moving past it. It's like I said at the beginning, this movie's about you know, this is the guy before the guy. And at the end, in that diner scene, as Mike is looking at the window, he's kind of like achieved adulthood, basically.
Yeah.
Like authentic adulthood of logical thought and realizing that, you know, these things are okay to an extent, but at some point you got to take yourself out of them.
Yep.
Yeah.
So. Absolutely.
So thank you for listening to The MacGuffin Man. Be sure to check back next week when we'll be talking about, is it Jurassic World yet? No, not Jurassic World. 2 weeks from now, Jurassic World. So if you're like James, you can get excited for that. If you're like me, you can start dreading that. But yeah.
Already got my ticket.
I know. anyway, we'll be back next week. Thanks.
Thanks for listening to The MacGuffin Men. Be sure to check out themacguffinmen.com for supplementary links, articles, and more. Thanks for listening.